It's good for us to be assembled this morning, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be with you and to have the opportunity to speak to you this morning. Several times in my life, I've been moving from one place to another and have had the occasion to worship with a group of brethren for the last time, at least on a regular basis. And when you know that you're with the Lord's people in a certain place on the Lord's Day and you might not ever see them again on the Lord's Day, it makes it a very special experience. And I've often wondered what a difference it would make in our assembly if we knew that the Lord was going to come back sometime this next week and this would be the last assembly of this congregation. It would probably be a very special assembly. And we ought, I think, to appreciate it all the time as if it might be the last, for it surely might. For all we know, the Lord might return at any time. I'm going to have the privilege of speaking to you both times today, this morning and also this evening. This will be the only Lord's Day that I'll be able to be with you during the month of September, next Lord's Day. Lord willing, I'll be with the brethren at Viking Drive in Bossier City, Louisiana, in a gospel meeting. The week after that, I will be in Southport, Indiana, in a meeting. And then the week after that, we'll be up in Minneapolis with Rick and Bonita Lanning, their brethren up there in a meeting. So the schedule calls for me to do double duty today. I got up this morning and thought, what an unusual thing to have to preach both times on the Lord's Day. Probably an indication of how spoiled I've already gotten living here at Broadmoor. But I want to take advantage of the fact that I'll have both of the lessons today to talk about two lessons that really do need to go together and are appropriately preached on the same day. I want this morning to talk with you about the first verse in the Bible, and then tonight, this afternoon, to talk with you about the last verse in the Bible and to see what we might learn from looking at the very first thing that God says to us in His Word, and then what I think is the last thing that was written in the Bible, and to see what those say about the contents of all that is in between those two verses. Butch read just a moment ago the first five verses of Genesis 1. We're really only going to be looking at verse 1, which says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Not a few of our problems in life come from beginning at the wrong place. If you start with the wrong information, or if you start at the wrong place, you build on the wrong foundation, and that always gives bad results, doesn't it? Our search for truth needs to begin at the right place. Kevin mentioned this morning in the beginning of our study in Proverbs, that very familiar statement in Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10, for we're told that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. To understand that the Lord exists and to have the proper reverence for Him, that's not just the ABCs of knowledge, that's the A that goes before even the B and the C. And it's no coincidence that the Bible begins where it does, by telling us that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the truth, the fundamental first truth upon which the rest of God's entire revelation to mankind rests. And we need to come to terms with the importance of that very simple truth, that it was in the beginning that God created the heavens and the earth. So the first truth that we are presented with in the Bible is the truth that God is real. It's not just an idea, not just something nice to think about, but God is an objective reality. The fact that He is an unseen reality doesn't mean that He is any less real than the things that we can see. Even if you can't see God, you certainly can see the world in which you live, can't you? It is obvious that something exists. Rather than nothing. But why is there something rather than nothing? That's an interesting question. It really involves two separate questions. First of all, I'd ask the question, who is responsible for the fact that we exist? And the Bible takes a position about that. that it was God who created not only us, but the world in which we live. There are certainly people who don't accept that that's true. There'd be people who would dispute the position that the Bible takes. But we need to be straightforward enough to understand and not try to explain around the fact that the Bible takes the position that there was a God who created the heavens and the earth. And it's not just childish curiosity or intellectual interest that causes us to ask that question, you know, why is there what exists? You'd have a hard time living life in any kind of good way if you didn't have some kind of explanation for why there is what there is. The question of why we're here is a very important question. We simply cannot live without a basic explanation of life. The question is not whether you're going to have an explanation of why you're here. It's only going to be the question of whether you have a good explanation of why you're here. Everybody has to have some explanation. Most of modern science these days would put it in the form of a what rather than a who. Many would say we ought not to ask who is responsible for what exists, but just what is responsible for what exists. But that's not really a reasonable alternative. And Paul points out why that's not a reasonable alternative in Acts chapter 17, when he was talking to the philosophers in the city of Athens as he was passing through that city and had occasion to discuss the gospel with some of these fellows. And as he began to talk to them in Acts chapter 17 at verse 24, he raised the issue of God. He had already pointed out that Athens was a city filled with temples where various kinds of gods were worshipped. And so Paul basically says, let me tell you something about the idea of a different kind of God than you may have ever thought about. Acts 17:24, Paul says, God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. That he is not a physical, tangible reality, such as the idols that you worship in your temples. Nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life and breath and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. Now, before we read the next verse, notice that Paul is arguing that God is a personal God. He's not a what, he is a who. Now, Paul's going to explain why it's reasonable to believe that. Even if you didn't have the Bible, it would be reasonable to believe that God is a personal God. Verse 28, for in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. Now, before we read the next verse, just notice that Paul raises a problem here, that even the Greeks should understand, whose own poets had said, we are the offspring of God. Well, we know what we are. We are personal beings. And if we are personal beings, how could we have come from some creature who was less than we are? Whoever created us would have to be at least as much as we are and more. Therefore, he says, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by our art and man's devising. Not only can nothing, something can't come from nothing, personal beings can't come from impersonal matter. Persons have to come from a personal creator. And so the question is not what is responsible for the fact that we are here, it's who is responsible. And the Bible takes that position, doesn't it? In the beginning, God, a personal creating God, made the heavens and the earth. And Paul says here in this passage that it's in him that we live and move and have our being. Not only did he create us, he sustains us at every instant. The idea that God created the world and then withdrew from it and just kind of let it run on its own is not a very reasonable idea. This world not only had to be created, it has to be sustained every instance. The Creator removed his hand from his creation, it would cease to exist. And so the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3, who being the express, speaking of Christ, the express or the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power. So God upholds or sustains this world. We live in the atmosphere of God, so to speak. We are surrounded by him. He's involved in the world that he created. And you turn just a few pages over in Hebrews to chapter 11. Read with me beginning in verse 1. Hebrews 11 and verse 1 says that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith, he said, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of the things which are visible. So even though God is an unseen reality, we have compelling evidence to believe that he not only created the universe in which we live, he created us as personal beings in his image. And we acknowledge the truth of what we believe about that every time we sing that wonderful song, "This is my Father's world." This all didn't just happen. God created us, and he made us, and the world that he made for us to live in. But what ought to be our response to that? If you read in the first verse of the Bible that God created the heavens and the earth, if that's the what, is there a so what that would go with that? Does that make any difference? Well, it ought to make a huge difference. And I believe the problem of what I call practical atheism is a huge problem in the world that we live. There are a lot of people who are theoretical atheists who say they don't believe there is a God. I believe there are a lot more people who say they believe there is a God, but they live like they don't believe that. They live as if they were atheists, as if it didn't make any practical difference in their life that God exists. And you recall Paul's statement in Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, where he talked about people who knew God, but they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful. And so the truth that God made the world, that simple truth of Genesis 1, verse 1, has vast implications. If that's true, and it is, then that means we are accountable to this God who created us. It means that he has authority over us. He has the right to command our behavior. And it means that he will determine our destiny. If he is our creator, then where we go from the point that he created us has a lot to do with this God who gave us our being. And so, how seriously, on a day-to-day practical basis, do we deal with this truth of Genesis 1 and verse 1, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth? I think the problem for many of us is that though we would readily acknowledge the truth of Genesis 1 verse 1, some of the time, that doesn't seem very real to us, does it? Because the truth of that is in the unseen realm. He's a spiritual being who can't be experienced with our five physical senses. There's some days when it's just hard for that to be as real to us as it ought to be. You know, there's a big difference between knowing something and really knowing that it's true. I was thinking as Kevin was talking this morning about the Proverbs. How many verses there are in Proverbs that I've known all of my life and would have said I believe that those things were true, but I've really discovered the truth of some of them only in recent years. Knew them all along, but it's only been, I think, since I turned about 50 that the light has gone on about how really true some of those proverbs are. There's a difference between knowing something and knowing it at the experiential level. And so, do we know that God exists? Yes, that's an easy thing to voice at the intellectual level. But day in and day out, how real is that to you? How much impact that makes on your life has a lot to do with how real it is to you. If you think of it as just some vague, shadowy truth, it's probably not going to have much of a practical difference in the way you live Monday through Saturday, whatever difference it might make on Sunday. But I'll tell you what, if it doesn't seem very real to you on some days right now, I'm going to predict a time when it will become very real to you. And that is when you lie upon your deathbed. And you face your mortality and your imminent departure from this world that God made. It probably will become a lot more real to you than it might seem right now. Wouldn't it be great if God could be as real to us every day as he obviously will be when we face our physical death? So the challenge becomes dealing with that truth in such a way that it becomes real right now, not just at the end of our life. It's ironic, isn't it, that we have to work on dealing with really what is most the obvious reality in the universe. Romans chapter 1, Paul says that the things that have been made don't just manifest God's existence. He says God clearly manifests himself by those things. There is a sense in which the existence of God is the most obvious fact in the universe. It's astonishing, really, that anybody would miss that. It's obvious enough that children have an easy time with that. We have to outgrow the ease with which we believe that to be true. It has to become difficult to us. But it's a fairly obvious thing. It's not doubted or disputed because it's not clear. There are other reasons why that becomes unreal to us later on. But I believe there are two things that will help make it real and keep it real to us. And you've heard me say both of these things before. We need, first of all, to spend more time with God's world. If the things that are made are the evidence of the one who made them, that evidence is not going to have very much impact on us if we don't deal with the things that God has made. Now, don't quibble with me. I understand that in a general sense, everything in the world has been made by God. There's not anything that God hasn't made. But I'm talking about the things that God made directly and that haven't been recycled by mankind. This building, in a direct sense, in an indirect sense, was made by God, but we've taken the raw materials and we've done enough stuff to it that we can say this was man-made. And the problem is that we spend most of our lives anymore in our society dealing with mostly man-made things, and we have less and less contact directly with the things that God made. And so those things have less and less of a chance to work their magic on us and to have the effect on us that God intended them to have. When Paul was preaching in Iconium, or in Lystra, in Acts chapter 14 and verse 17, he's speaking of God. He said, "Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness," and so forth. Paul says the world in which we live is a part of the witness that God has left for us to consider that he exists. So we need to deal with that evidence and spend more time with the world that God made so that it can make its impression upon us. But more important than that, we need to spend more time in God's Word. Not just his world, but his Word. God's reality confronts us on every page of the Scriptures, doesn't it? And we need to study the Bible with the intent of letting it have that effect upon us, to make God more real to us. We spend much of our time, I guess, in the Bible studying information that we're looking for about God, and the fact that he's a person sometimes gets lost in the shuffle of all of that detailed information. But we ought to study the Bible with a view to coming to know God himself. I want to read to you a statement that was made back in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 39, that makes a point that I think is good for us to consider. Moses here is talking and he says, Deuteronomy 4, verse 39, "Therefore know this day and consider it in your hearts that the Lord himself is God in heaven above, and on the earth beneath there is no other. Moses said, don't just know that, consider it. That means think about it. Meditate on it. Soak in it. Let it sink in. And that doesn't happen unless we spend time not just breezing over that truth, but thinking about it in an extended way. I'm beginning to learn the value of truly meditating on certain statements that are made in the Scripture. Now, you've heard me say in teaching Bible classes that I'm a big advocate of getting the big picture. So you read all of a book at one time to get a feel for the whole thing. There's time and a place for that, but there's also a time and a place to drill down and think about some single, simple statement, like, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and just fix your mind on that single truth and think about it for an extended period of time. Meditate on it. Resist the temptation to run on to verse 2. Think about that simple statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Do what Moses said here. Consider it in your heart. And when we do, God will become more real to us. I think we need to recover the lost art of reflection and extended thought and meditation. It's a crying shame that the word meditation has been taken over by the Buddhists. It's a perfectly good word. We find it in the Psalms a lot. It simply means thinking about something for more than just a second or two. Replaying it in your mind and looking at it from different angles and just letting it soak into us. And so, how long could you sit and think about Genesis 1 and verse 1 before you exhausted everything that was in that verse? I bet you could think about it for hours and there'd be still different things to think about in that one verse. So I recommend that we need to spend more time in contact with God's world and with His Word, and He'll become more real to us. So the first verse in the Bible teaches us that we came from God. It's also true that we will return to God. As Solomon said in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 6 and 7. Body will return to the dust from which it came, the spirit to God. And so God is our origin. He made us, but He's also our destiny. He's where we're going to in the end. We are right to be concerned about the prevalence of atheism in our age. But what about that problem of practical atheism that I talked about? What about us? Do we really believe that God created the heavens and the earth, or do we merely profess to believe that? We can make all kind of theoretical arguments against atheism and evolution and all of those things, but those will mean very little to our kids if they don't see us living lives that exhibit genuine belief in the reality of all of that. And we need to work on that. Considering our eventual return to the God who made us, we ought to live each day in practical recognition of our accountability to Him. He didn't just make us. We will stand in judgment before Him. We ought to live our lives for God. And that's the point, of course, that the book of Ecclesiastes closes with. The whole duty of our lives, the whole of what it is to be a human being, is to fear God and keep His commandments. If you miss that point, then you just miss the whole point of being a human being in this world. That's what it's about. We don't want to miss that point. Our principal purpose in life ought to be to please the God who made us. That's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, verses 9 and 10. We make it our aim, whether present or absent, to be well pleasing to Him. Well, it's a wonderful truth that the God of our creation is also the God of our salvation. And that's where we'll go with the lesson tonight. But that's contained in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10, which says, it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, that's Genesis 1 and 1, in bringing many sons to glory to make the author of their salvation perfect through sufferings. So Genesis 1 and verse 1 lays down the essential foundation that we have been made by God, but that sets up the issue that the rest of the Bible will talk about. Page after page after page in the Bible, there are many things said about what happens after God created the heavens and the earth, and the problem that came into being, that the Bible tells the story of God's solution to that problem. So I hope you can come back at 5 this afternoon, and we'll jump all the way over to the last page, like we sometimes do with books that we're browsing at Barnes & Noble. You know, you look at the first few pages, and you flip over there and look at the last page. We're going to look at the last page and the last verse on the last page tonight and see what that bookend tells us with this first bookend that we've looked at this morning, and to see what those two verses tell us about what that story is all about. And how important that story ought to be to you and me every day that we live. So I would be very surprised if there's anybody in the room this morning who would say, I don't believe God created the heavens and the earth. You didn't believe that, you might not be here. We believe it. But do we deal seriously with that truth? Do we deal seriously with it? If you're here this morning and you are outside of a right relationship with that God, then at least up to now, you haven't dealt as you should with that truth that God made you and that you're accountable to Him. And the main thing that ought to be on your mind as we sing the invitation song here in just a moment is what you are going to do about this fact that you say you believe, and that is that God made you. And that you are accountable to Him. If there's something you need to do about that, something that you've learned you need to do from studying the Scriptures, but you haven't done it, and we want to implore you, to beg you, no less, to think seriously about that. And if we can help you in whatever way to take some step that will put you closer to God than you were when you got here this morning for Bible study or for worship, then we'd love to help you take that step. Let us know how we can help you. Won't you come forward as we stand and sing the song that's been announced?